Uncovering the Bronze Age, Episode 1, with your host, Emily J. So first things first, you might have noticed a change of title between my first official episode and my 0th one. Even though I liked the title, even I thought it was misleading and kind of confusing. It really needs to say Bronze Age just so that people know what they're getting into when they listen to my show. Otherwise, people who just Googled Bronze Age podcast wouldn't find me, and I'd probably get a lot of emails complaining about why I wasn't talking about 40s Batman. Also, the title no longer specifies DC. I'm still going to primarily review DC comics because that's what I know and it's really what I'm interested in, but I did want to leave open the possibility of talking about a Marvel or independent here and there. But don't hold your breath. It'll be a while before I talk about the awesomeness that is Power Man and Iron Fist, heroes for hire. But as a side note, it's totally awesome. Anyway, on to the story. I'll be starting this show with an issue of Superman, since it is his 75th birthday this year, and this is the only way I could think of to cash in on Man of Steel without actually forcing myself to go see it. The point of this podcast is both to read stories that I know are important, well-written, or just plain infamous, as well as finding hidden gems of my own. So I figured a good way to start would be with one of the stories that's pointed to as the first attempt to distance Superman from his previous norm of Silver Age silliness and superdickery. This is Superman number 233, Superman Breaks Loose, written by Denny O'Neil with art by Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson, cover dated January 1971, with an original price of 15 cents. Okay, the show is mostly going to be positive, but I just have to pause and bitch for a second about how much I wished that I lived in the 1970s. I could have just gone and picked up a handful of comics for the price of a milkshake. Damn it, New 52. Anyway, moving along to the actual issue, the cover is incredibly iconic. The image of Superman breaking out of chains has been used in a couple of trades, like Superman in the 70s. I'm actually reading this from a trade myself, Kryptonite Nevermore, which was the cover title for the book. It collects the 1971 issues of Superman and provides a handy spoiler for what's going to happen in the arc. The picture is Superman in all of his square-jawed glory busting out of a green chain with his cape flying, and it's lit with this giant flash from behind. It's just really great. I do chuckle a little bit at the attempts to make this look like a new number one issue with a giant number one best-selling comics magazine in the corner. It just reminds me of modern tricks to try and boost comic sales by offering jumping on points. I do enjoy the story, and it does create a new status quo very effectively that a new reader could follow. It just makes me giggle to think how similar the modern comics industry with its issue zeros and point ones is similar to the one that existed 40 plus years ago. Looking inside, the story starts with a splash page that looks like Superman is watching himself use his powers on three TV screens. In all three, he's posed very dramatically, but the actual Superman is sort of hunched over and kind of looks like he's going to fall on his face. His back is to the reader and the whole body is shadowed, so it looks very ominous and intriguing. Superimposed over the cape, the narrator says, "Invulnerability, strength, speed, all these things and many more combine to make Superman the most powerful being on Earth. But there is another side to the Man of Steel, a dark side, hidden from both the crowds of admirers and the evil men who hate and fear him." There are three text boxes at the top of the page reading, "Beginning, a return to greatness, Superman." The story itself begins with Superman flying towards some military, scientific, complex thingy in a desert somewhere in the western United States. He thinks to himself, "I'm running a risk being here. If anything goes wrong with Professor Bolden's experiment, it could be fatal to me." Turns out that Superman is there to supervise the first tests of a kryptonite engine that could provide cheap electricity to virtually every underdeveloped area in the world. This noble goal is immediately destroyed when the scientist flips the switch and an emergency alarm starts blaring. Turns out that even though Professor Holden is a scientist who has been studying kryptonite for, one would assume, months, maybe years, he didn't actually calculate how much energy his engine would produce and check that against how much it could contain. Now the whole thing is gonna blow. Now it's kind of funny from the artistic side because this engine doesn't look anything like you would expect it to. This thing looks kind of like a big ring with nuclear towers, like little tiny nuclear towers that are just sticking out of it in all these different directions. Like, it looks like something you would give a baby to chew on, but it's dark green and it's emitting this light green radiation, And it looks exactly like the Green Lantern symbol. Just because it's green and appears to be made of some kind of mineral, it's not actually kryptonite. Like maybe this professor actually found a Green Lantern power battery and just started plugging shit into it. Well, Superman flies off, a little annoyed, but not very surprised that this scientist turned out to be an idiot, because he's prepared for this. He flies back to the complex carrying this giant lead-coated dome, smashing through the ceiling of the complex. But before he can throw the giant lead over the engine, it explodes, and it just peels the lead shielding off like it's candy wrapper. Superman is hurled sideways by the force of the explosion out of the wall and into the desert, thinking, "I took a face full of K radiation. Could be fatal." He drops to the desert floor and lies still as a stone. Well, the scientists gather around and start thinking, "Shit, we just killed Superman." But after a few moments, a dazed Superman sits up. They worry that the explosion might have done something to him, but he says he feels fine, just a little unsteady on his feet. Now, when he stands up, he doesn't leave a crater. It's this perfect outline of his body with a cape and everything. It's like Tom and Jerry running through a wall or something. And it's in sand, which isn't really solid and shouldn't be able to hold the shape, but whatever. Any questions about science are immediately tossed aside as one of the other scientists comes running up, holding a chunk of kryptonite, like, "Look at this!" Professor Bolden, with his PhD in kryptonitology, jumps in front of Superman and starts waving at the other guy, like, "Get away, you fool! That can kill Superman!" This guy might actually just be a professor of exposition, now that I think about it. But the second guy is just like, "No way! The explosion changed it to ordinary iron!" And again, Professor Kryptonology butts in and says, "That is impossible. Just as impossible as it is for me to mistake a Green Lantern power ring for a chunk of kryptonite, or to forget how to calculate the energy readouts of my own invention." Oh, wait. The actual expert on kryptonite, Superman, pops in and says, "No, not impossible. I'd be out cold if I stood this close to green kryptonite, you idiot." Wait, this close? He's touching you with it! This isn't a question of... You're poking him with kryptonite! He would be dead! Oh, God. Well, the incompetence brigade fills out as a third scientist shows up late to the party with armfuls of kryptonite, screaming, "Professor Bolden! This kryptonite we had stored in the vault! It's changed to..." And Professor Supergenius just cuts him off, like, "I know, it's iron. God, Steve, that's so obvious. I'm a scientist, and I fully expected this to happen. Only an idiot would question..." Oh, wait. Superman notes that the vault is a considerable distance from the lab and theorizes that if the explosion affected kryptonite that far away, what about the rest of the green kryptonite on Earth? He flies away to investigate this possibility, leaving behind four befuddled scientists, who now have two holes in their facility, a destroyed super engine, the knowledge that all the data that they have dedicated years of their lives to gathering is now invalidated, and a Superman-shaped divot in their front yard. Good job, Superman. As we turn the page, we see a copy of the Daily Planet with the headline, "Kryptonite Destroyed." Now he's really invulnerable. Jimmy runs in waving the copy of the paper, yelling about how awesome it is that now Superman is only vulnerable to magic. Wait, so he's not really invulnerable? Daily Planet, you lied to me! Clark agrees with his best friend that it is indeed wonderful, but is careful not to be too excited, since Lois Lane is sitting right behind him, watching his every move. Off-panel, we hear some douchebag say, "I don't think it's so wonderful, Kent." Turns out the douchebag is Morgan Edge, president of the Galaxy Broadcasting System, which now owns the Daily Planet. Jimmy and Lois are like, "What the fuck, man? What's your beef with Superman?" And Morgan Edge actually has a valid response. "The same thing I'd have against anyone supremely powerful. I don't trust anyone who can't be stopped. A wise man once said that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. How do we know Superman is an exception?" And while that's a reasonable concern to have about Superman, since he is so much more powerful than everyone else on the planet combined, he punctuates his point by gesturing with a cigarette in this giant gold holder, so I feel validated in calling him a douche. My suspicions are indeed confirmed mere seconds later as he throws a camera at Clark and says, "Here, Kent, take this portable television transmission and cover the launching of the new mail rocket." When Clark questions this idea, seeing as he's a newspaperman, Morgan Edge continues his douchebaggery by saying, "You're my employee. If I say you're working for the TV station, then you are. Clear?" Clark acquiesces and walks out of the Daily Planet building with the miniature camera in tow. He thinks that this new position could complicate his life. "As a newsman, I was free to switch identities. Nobody could keep close tabs on me. But as a broadcaster, I'll be in full view of millions." However, there's nothing he can do since Morgan Edge is, indeed, the boss. So he goes to the launch site and sets up his first broadcast. Now, I was actually a little impressed with the technology here. A lot of times when they spotlight cool tech in comics like these, they just look dated and embarrassing by this point in time. This is 2013. But even by today's standards, this news camera and stand look pretty compact, and it seems even to have a built-in satellite dish or something for live broadcasts. In homes around Metropolis, Clark reports that he is on site for the launching of the first transcontinental mail rocket. According to him, postal authorities boast it will greatly speed mail delivery from Metropolis to Los Angeles. What? Okay, I just gave the tech a little praise for realism, but this rocket? It's a rocket! Like, it looks like it's waiting to take Tintin to the moon. This thing is like 10 stories tall and covered in scaffolding. And it's intended to fly from Metropolis, which is basically New York, to Los Angeles. New York to California. You can drive there in a couple of days. But no, that's too slow. The US government is going to lend its experimental rockets to the Postal Service to speed up delivery of mail from the East Coast to the West Coast. They even specify it'll take 10 minutes. 10 minutes! Okay. Using a truck, it takes what? A week to get your mail? And probably half of that isn't the driving, it's the processing. So to cut delivery time from a week to 2 days and 10 minutes, you're going to spend millions of dollars. It's basically a second space program, but you aren't going to Mars, you're going to California. Now, we can joke that California is basically a different country, but it's not a different planet. Why do you need a rocket? Whatever. This rocket is basically just an excuse to get Clark in the vicinity of a criminal, since, as we all know, if it's expensive and explodes, someone in Metropolis is going to try and steal it because everyone in the city is a kleptomaniac or a psychopath or both. As Clark wraps up this section of his broadcast, he looks through the wall and sees this seedy-looking, obviously evil guy. As soon as the signal breaks for broadcast, Clark speeds around the corner, changing clothes as he goes, knowing he has only 3 minutes to take care of this guy. In another well-composed panel, the balding, shading clearly evil henchman is calling his boss on a giant cell phone, telling him that the rocket is ready to launch. Superman appears half a foot away from the guy and tries to horn in on the conversation. Now, I'm not sure if this panel is supposed to be funny, but the contrast between this short, balding dude and Superman in all his supermanitude is just hysterical to me. This dude seems unfazed, though, and proceeds to explain his boss's plan to steal the rocket and sell it to other nations. Yes, the Russians will pay you loads for the ability to build their own incredibly ridiculous, overpriced national mail carriage system. Idiot. The attempted hijacker reassures the audience that he's not a complete idiot, however, by popping open a case that he brought with him. I don't mind telling you, 'cause you ain't gonna live long enough to do anything about it. See? Kryptonite. Superman just laughs in his face. Either you haven't seen a paper or can't read. Mind if I try some? And he grabs the chunk of kryptonite right out of this dude's hand and takes a bite out of it like it's a freaking meatball, noting that it makes a fine snack, but could use some salt. The criminal promptly shits his pants. Now again, I gotta question the science here. I get that Superman is super invulnerable, super strong. But is he secretly Matter Eater Lad? 'Cause he just took a bite out of a ball of iron. I'm seriously confused by this. Because it's a good panel layout, and it's pretty well known, much like the cover, this image of Superman eating kryptonite like it's an apple. But it makes no sense if you think about it. Does he have super digestion? Can he super masticate? Because I was not aware of these powers, if so. And this isn't 1962. This is the story that establishes the Bronze Age of DC Comics. But it just casually blitzes this little piece of nonsense right through, and no one bats an eye. Anyway. Superman flicks this guy in the chin, knocking him out, before running back to the camera, changing back to Clark Kent as he goes. He makes it back just in time for the commercial break to end and the countdown to start. Under cover of the smoke and dust kicked up by the launch, Clark changes back to Superman again and takes off to follow the rocket. As soon as it's above the cloud cover, two jets appear to intercept it. Superman flies at the jets, thinking, "I've never felt so confident, knowing there's absolutely nothing that can harm me except magic. Morgan Edge was wrong. Power isn't corrupting me, it's freeing me to do unlimited good." At that moment, inside the jet, two more sneaky, obvious villain types open fire on Superman. And in a relapse of super dickery, Superman thinks, "I could easily dodge, but I might as well let them have their fun. It'll be the last they have for the next 20 years. Wah, wah, wah. When they run out of bullets, Superman flies next to them and attempts to fuse their electrical system with his heat vision, because it will be the safest way to stop the plane. No. No, it's not. Because you're combining heat, electricity, and wiring. It seems like when you melt the electrical system with your I-beams, that those systems could come in contact with each other, cause a short, and if you're not super careful, you could hit the gas line, and the entire thing will go up in flames. But whatever, I guess Clark's a super engineer too. Regardless, as he tries to use his heat vision, odd, my heat isn't penetrating the aircraft's hull. That's never happened before. No time to worry about it, though. I'll have to resort to rougher methods. So rather than the incredibly safe option of fusing the electrical system of a fighter jet in midair, Superman decides to rip open the top of the plane, hop inside, smash the pilot and co-pilot's heads together, and set the autopilot to land safely. He lands on the other plane, quipping that crook catching can get dull if you do the same thing over and over. Not sure if that was fourth wall breaking or not, but I liked it. This time, Superman uses his X-ray vision to target the crooks, then punches them through the roof of the jet. Wait. Oh, so I guess his X-ray vision worked, but his heat vision didn't. Okay. In the early 60s, they used to specify that he burned things up with the heat of his X-ray vision, but I guess by this point they've separated the two out. Well, Superman clocks both crooks in the head, liquefying their brains and reducing them to vegetable state for the rest of their lives. As he tows the second plate behind the first, Superman notes that the mail rocket has landed safely, with the technicians none the wiser. Still, he thinks, that temporary loss of heat vision bothers me. It's hard to worry, though, not when I know I'm safe from green kryptonite. As Superman prepares to land the planes, he looks down and notes that he is now directly over the spot where the K engine blew up at the start of this issue. Suddenly, Superman feels dizzy and exhausted, as though the strength is being drawn from his limbs. It's a new sort of weakness, worse than the effects of kryptonite. But a minute later, the fainting spell passes. Superman dismisses the feeling as an illusion, or the result of lingering radiation from the explosion. However, the panel implies differently. With the two jets setting down over the mountains in the distance, the foreground is filled with the outline of Superman, still sharply defined and ominously emphasized. Early the next morning, as Clark re-enters the Daily Planet offices, he is congratulated on his TV debut by Jimmy, while Lois says that Walter Cronkite has more presence. I'm assuming that's funny, so I'm gonna laugh. Morgan Edge appears with his Cruella de Vil cigarette holder and car salesman smile to agree, and that's why he's moving Clark to WGBS-TV permanently. Clark tries to refuse the offer, and Perry White backs him up, but Morgan Edge, being the platonic ideal of douche that he is, states, "You may be the editor, but I'm the boss." Clark, in the background of this bottom panel, thinks, "Trouble. That's what it means. Big trouble. Will Superman always have to wait for commercials?" I'm not sure whether that counts as a pun or a snappy one-liner, or if it was really supposed to be taken as a serious threat. Either way, it's kind of groan-worthy. And now for something completely different. Turning the page, we see the closing page of this story, simply entitled Epilogue. The page is entirely devoid of dialogue and implies a slow zoom, centering on that desolate imprint of Clark left in the desert. The captions read, "Even as Clark ponders new complications, a blazing sun beats upon the desert, upon a figure in the sand, and rising out of Clark's imprint is a 3D version of Superman with no face that's made completely out of sand. And ever so slowly, it sits up. It is a thing created from soil and rock and a burst of raw energy cast in the mold of Superman. It slowly stands up and begins to shamble away from the reader. Like some nightmare creature, it plods towards the distant mountains and towards the villages and towns and cities beyond, moving slowly, relentlessly, to a terrible destiny." And that concludes the story. Wow, that was a really long recap. Well, it looks like it's time to take a break. For me to get a drink, let's play some promos, and when I come back, I'll tell you what I thought of the issue.
The dawn of an age. The founding of a family.
You know we haven't done enough research into the effects of cosmic rays.
We've got to take that chance.
Conditions are right tonight. Let's go.
They're penetrating the ship. Our shielding isn't strong enough.
I feel like I'm burning up.
Too heavy.
Can't move.
Too heavy.
We're all alive.
I feel so strange.
You're fading away. I can't see you at all anymore.
Look what's happened to you. You're changing.
Oh, Reed, not you too.
What happened to me? to all of us.
I can fly!
We gotta use that power to help mankind, right?
And so was born the Fantastic Four.
For soon the Mole Man will have the entire world in his power!
I am the mightiest living mortal on Earth. And now, mankind shall feel that might.
The Fantastic Four. Little do they dream they're the palms in the hands of Dr. Doom.
The Human Torch will be the Puppet Master's next victim.
You Earthlings can't change the way I can. That means I'm the most powerful person on Earth.
I've been expecting you, for I am the Thinker.
I vow never to return, my lord, until the Fantastic Four are no more and the planet Earth is no more.
You're in the presence of the awesome Ralatons, King of Kings, Master of Men, and Lord of the Seven Suns.
Fool, you're just a muscular freak, blind or Hulk.
Stop! You must not enter the Castle of Diablo.
My journey has ended. This planet shall sustain me until it has been drained of all elemental life. So speaks Galactus.
Flame on!
It's clobbering time!
The Fantastic Four from the very beginning. Witness the origins of a legend. The Fantasticast. ffcast.libsyn.com.
In the decade of the 1970s and 80s, not even the great city of Metropolis could be spared the ravages of an energy crisis, super criminal attacks, or disco. The job of protecting the city fell to Superman, whose battle for truth, justice, and the American way made him a symbol of hope for the city of Metropolis. Charlie Niemeyer, in association with the Superman Podcast Network, presents Superman in the Bronze Age. Superman of the Bronze Age is a bi-weekly podcast highlighting the Bronze Age adventures of the Man of Steel in various comic titles. Follow along at www.supermanofthebronzeage.com.
Before I go any further, I want to take a moment and thank some of the podcasters who've really helped me and my dad to hit the ground running when it comes to starting up this whole podcast thing. Guys like Sean Angle, or Billy Hogan from Superman Fan Podcast, the guys from Fantasticast. So just thank you everyone who's been giving us any advice or playing our promos. It's really appreciated. Now back to the issue. Time for some historical context. Something that really defines the Bronze Age is that it was the first crop of comic writers and artists who grew up reading comic books themselves. In the Golden and Silver Ages, comic writers and artists tend to rotate more. There wasn't this emphasis on a specific writer or artist's run of issues or their take on a character, and a lot of people involved in comics were somewhat peripheral. A lot of times people would work on a story or two in between advertising jobs or other sort of graphic design work. Basically, there were fewer professional comic artists and comic writers. Denny O'Neil was a prolific comic writer in the early 70s. We are going to see a lot of him on this show. Part of the reason that he became involved with Superman was to revitalize the character and create a brand new status quo. The intro to this trade discusses how Mort Weisinger had recently retired, and the new editor, Julie Schwartz, was taking the opportunity to revitalize characters and shift around creative teams. Hence why he contacted O'Neil, who was at the time writing his legendary Green Lantern Green Arrow series. O'Neil actually said he was never very comfortable with the character of Superman, since he tends to thrive on characters that focus on personal drama, street-level crime-fighting, that sort of thing. It's not very surprising. He asked once how it was possible to write a compelling story about a character who could destroy a galaxy by listening hard. But it's that sort of attitude that really inspired him to revamp the Man of Steel. After years of 60s continuity, Superman's range of powers and abilities had grown ridiculous. ridiculously large. He could basically hear everything, see everything, be everywhere. That was the age of super ventriloquism, super law, super everything. With this in mind, O'Neill's two goals for his run were removing kryptonite, which really was Superman's only external weakness, and simultaneously weaken him enough to introduce actual danger and tension for our main character. While Denny O'Neill was regressing Superman's power level and cleaning up some baggage from his mythos, the editors took the chance to also rework Superman's civilian status quo. Hence the introduction of Morgan Edge, who was a more hostile figure than Perry White, and Clark's transition from a newsman to a TV reporter. Both of these changes added conflict to Clark's civilian life, especially when it's later revealed that Morgan Edge is actually working for Darkseid of the planet Apocalypse. If you don't know who that is, don't worry. We'll get there soon enough. But after all this talk about a new status quo in the start of the Bronze Age, the story is still a little bit silly. After all, at the time it was written, this was just another Superman story, and it retained a lot of the tropes from the 1960s. Fortunately, Lois Lane barely appears, and appears to be far less obsessive about either Clark or Superman by this point. Consider this a soft reboot that still retains some of the Silver Age silliness. Things like the mail rocket, which I looked up, it did exist once upon a time, though, financially, never worked. And Superman's sudden ability to ingest iron are remnants from this earlier age that didn't distract much from the story that Denny O'Neill was really trying to tell. Now, as I've stated several times, I legitimately enjoyed this issue. The writing is adequate, if somewhat on the nose at points. There are moments that are legitimately funny, but most of those are a result of the art, not the dialogue. It's kind of funny to remember that once upon a time, a lot of comic characters tended to sound a lot alike. That is, the Superman in this episode and the Batman from next episode both sound a lot like Spider-Man. The incredibly vociferous, joke-cracking superhero trope was really common during the 60s, and it retained the norm into the 70s. The character does come through. You do believe that Superman and Clark Kent would say these things, but it retains that universal superheroic quality that's just very recognizable. It's going to be interesting to see how that changes in following issues and years. I talked about the art a lot during the recap, and that's because it is absolutely the best part of the issue. Kurt Swan's pencils and Murphy Anderson's inks work excellently together. All of the characters are well-defined and distinct, even incidental background characters like the scientists or the criminals. The faces are very expressive, and the style is clean without being caricatured. Another thing that I started to notice as I read or reread more... I've mentioned Tintin a couple of times, and I am very fond of Hergé's clean-line style. The only problem is that then his characters don't really look like human beings, which is fine for the sort of story that you're going to tell, but I think Swan and Anderson really are able to walk that line between a stylized version of a person and someone that still looks believable. Another thing that I've started to notice as I read and reread more modern comics, say from the 90s and early 2000s, is a real lack of backgrounds. Swan and Anderson are able to establish various settings for all of the different scenes really well, and the settings remain consistent. It's something that you don't really think of having to point out, except it's done very well. But the hero of the art really is the layouts, just the way that the panels are arranged. The transitions from one scene and one page to the next are excellent, especially on page 5, which opens with the headline from the Daily Planet. The panels are not at all repetitive. They vary in size and shape to give a great sense of motion. They flow well from one to the other without being either jerky or decompressed. The story is only 15 pages long, but it's willing to slow down at times, such as the comedic scene of Superman eating the X-Kryptonite, which takes 4 whole panels, or the scene where Clark changes into his costume, accomplished with 5 images of Superman running through the panel as he transforms. Swan also makes a great use of depth and angle in his art. A great example is the panel at the bottom of page 5, where Morgan Edge delivers his speech about Superman. It's framed like a low-angle shot from a movie, and gives the panel a great sense of foreboding, both for Morgan Edge's sinister nature and his legitimately ominous warning. There's no word for it except dynamic. Everything in the art really does work to the advantage of the story. Swan's poses are dynamic and eye-catching, and Anderson's inks are never so detailed or simplistic that they're distracting. Although I mocked the perfect outline of Superman in the sand, it turns out that the strange amount of emphasis was actually foreshadowing for the epilogue. It's moments like that in the art that really elevate this issue to a whole nother level for me. As for the story itself, yeah, it's a tad silly. Especially when you realize that this 9-issue run was intended to make Superman's story more simple and relatable, the convoluted turns that it ends up taking to depower him become ridiculous in retrospect. Honestly, the explosion that somehow turns all of the kryptonite on Earth into iron through science is the most sensible part of the plot. However, it works well for the story, and manages to walk the fine line between believable and laughable that Denny O'Neil is so well known for in his great Green Lantern run. We'll come back to Kryptonite Nevermore a few episodes from now to follow up on Superman's evolution from god to mere demigod. Next episode will be another Denny O'Neil offering, this time from the Dark Knight Detective. Catch you later. This has been a Relatively Geeky production. Tune in to the Relatively Geeky podcast feed for this and other shows at www.relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or search for Relatively Geeky or Uncovering the Bronze Age in iTunes. If you have feedback for this show or any other show on our feed, email us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com or leave a rating or review on iTunes.